egregious, grievous, and the only thing that is preventing Israel from being held accountable on the world stage is the U.S.'s veto power at the U.N. Security Council. And so it has to come back to us mounting that movement here, and, you know, forming some sort of resistance against this government.
I just wanted to just reiterate again that I thought it was, I think your film was brilliant. I think it's one of the most important films about Palestine since John Pilger's Palestine Is Still the Issue, which is, you know, one of my favorite films of all time, and it's still sadly relevant.
Timeless.
You know.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was a wonderful film. You did a really good job, and all our listeners should go and buy it or rent it immediately. So thank you very much, Abby, for coming on the show.
Wow, that's I'm incredibly honored to hear that. I can't thank you enough for that compliment. And Nora, I respect your work so much. You've both had a profound impact on me, and you know, it's really important that we stand together and keep fighting. And people can check it out at GazaFightsForFreedom.com. We also have DVDs up for sale now. So thank you so much for the opportunity, and I'm really honored to be on. Thanks so much.
Just wanna take a little time out to you. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Tumation needs us.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Between the Covers, host David Naiman will be discussing the Book of Lost Saints, an evocative multi-generational Cuban-American family story of revolution, loss, and family bonds with New York Times bestselling author Daniel Jose Alder. KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. By making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for over $4,000 of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is writer, editor, and composer Daniel Jose Alder. Alder is the author of the young adult series Shadow Shaper Cipher. The first book, Shadow Shaper, was a New York Times notable book, winner of the International Latino Book Award, shortlisted for the Kirkus Prize in Young Readers Literature, and named one of Esquire's 80 books every person should read. He's also the author of Salsa Nocturna, a linked collection of stories of supernatural noir, as well as the Bone Street Roomba urban fantasy series, the middle grade historical Civil War era fantasy with dinosaurs called Dactyl Hill Squad, and Star Wars Last Shot, a Han Solo Lando Calrissian novel that shows us, among other things, a world of gender non-binary pilots and tech-savvy Ewok hackers, the domestic life of Han Solo as a politician's husband and insecure parent, and a much-needed corrective to the reductive Jar Jar Binks stereotype. Daniel Jose Alder's journalism on social justice, diversity, and gentrification appear regularly in The Guardian. His short prose, fiction, and nonfiction have been published at Tor.com, Strange Horizons, NPR, The New York Times, and BuzzFeed, among others, as well as in Jesmyn Ward's edited anthology, The Fire This Time, A New Generation Speaks About Race, and the Mothership anthology, Tales from Afrofuturism and Beyond. Alder also co-edited the Locus and World Fantasy-nominated anthology Long Hidden, Speculative Fiction from the Margins of History. He's facilitated workshops on storytelling, music, and anti-oppression organizing at public schools, religious houses, universities, and prisons, and was behind the ultimately successful petition to remove avowed racist H.P. Lovecraft as the model for the statue for the World Fantasy Awards. Daniel Jose Alder is here today to talk about his latest much-anticipated novel, out from Macmillan, entitled The Book of Lost Saints. Receiving a starred review from Publishers Weekly, Marlon James calls The Book of Lost Saints spellbinding, a fever dream full of magic and loss, wickedness and grace, faith and love, spirit and power. N.K. Jemisin adds that Older's book is a lyrical, beautiful, devastating, literally haunting journey of assimilation, resistance, and family. Finally, Lee Bardugo says, The Book of Lost Saints is a boldly drawn family saga that is equal parts mystery and ghost story, with details sharp enough to cut and characters who surprise at every turn. Welcome to Between the Covers, Daniel Jose Older.
Thank you. That was an incredibly comprehensive introduction. I sound amazing.
Yeah, you are amazing.
Thank you. I feel amazing after hearing all those great things that I guess I did.
You've done all those things.
I hadn't put it all together like that. Yeah. That's fantastic. I should take you with me on the road.
All right. Let's do it.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. So you've called The Book of Lost Saints a story of being lost in between. Mm. And one of the ways you've described this in-betweenness is the gap between the stories you heard of Cuba growing up as a child and the reality of visiting Cuba as an adult, and the ways these two things fit or didn't fit. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to start here with this goal of creating a story in the gaps between the imaginative and the real. So maybe we could start with, what were the stories that were conjured that either haunted you or kept you enraptured as a child about Cuba?
Sure. I think that's sort of the nightmare / paradise dream of so many children of exile and of diaspora is the stories we hear about the homeland and what does it mean and what doesn't it mean and how you put all the pieces together. I was lucky to grow up in a house that was very honest with about the challenges that they faced growing up, you know, in a time of revolution, in a time of dictatorship, without sugarcoating it and without going to the other extreme of just making everything into total monstrosities and inhumanity. That's not true for a lot of the discourse around Cuba. And I realized that when I looked out into the world and started taking in other points of view and reading up on it. And so one of the actual gaps is actually not even between what was actually there and what I heard so much as, you know, just all the different ways of telling a story. And some of them are lies and some of them are just different angles. It's just this huge Rashomon of complexity. And going there myself was just another piece of that puzzle. You know, I don't think it wasn't so much that, like, oh, now I understand it, right? It was like, oh, now I have my own stories and mythologies to add into this big mix of all these other voices. And that's a piece of this. But it's a very narrow piece, really, because as an outsider and everything except blood, who had only just done my homework and showed up at age 21, you know, all I could know was what I saw and what I understood and what I heard from the people I spoke to. And it's not even just that there's no one story. There's certainly no two stories. And that's actually the bigger lie I think we face with issues like as divisive as Cuba, is that there's this one side and there's this other side. And they're both so loud that we barely get to hear anything else. But it's really that most of the people, I think, fit somewhere in between those two sides. And those are the voices I was really trying to tap into with The Book of Lost Saints. Mm.
Well, you've described the time period when you visited Cuba as the twilight of one time and the dawn of another. And I would love for you to talk maybe just briefly about that time period, because that time period is obviously also going to be very different from the time period of, say, the Cuban Revolution or before the Cuban Revolution.
Exactly. And that's how this is sort of a doubly historical novel, which I didn't set out to do. I really thought it was just going to be, you know, so the premise real quick is, of course, Marisol is the narrator and she disappeared during the Cuban Revolution and she reemerges into the world as a spirit in New Jersey in 2004. And she's watching over her nephew and she's essentially tied to him. She's anchored to him spiritually in that if she gets too far, she starts to fade. And the only way she can access her own memories is through his dreams. So every time he goes to sleep, we get another anecdote from, or not anecdote, but moment of her life that she kind of shoves into his subconscious. So it's a dual narrative. Of course, we're getting her trying to get him to figure out what happened to her in 2004 New Jersey, and then we get her memories of revolutionary Cuba. Originally, it was just going to be set in sort of a vague present tense. And then I realized, I went back to, the first time I went to Cuba was in 2001. I returned a couple times more recently, and it's changed so dramatically since that time that I was there, that I realized I had to set it much more closely in order to talk about the Cuba that I saw when I visited that first time. That was the very end of the special period. The special period is a euphemistic name, if there ever was one. It's a terrible time for Cuba. Apagones, which means blackouts, giant blackouts, were a constant. Everything was short in terms of, no one had anything, barely. So it was a difficult time. And most of all, the feeling in the street was very low. There was a lot of fear from my experience of walking around. It wasn't the stereotypical celebratory Caribbean nation that you want to believe is there. You know, when you think about Cuba, people weren't out. If they were, they were tourists, and people catering to tourists. And that in itself was a little bit heartbreaking.
We should mention the so-called special period began with the fall of the Soviet Union, and then all of the funding and undergirding support that Cuba was depending upon.
Right. So, of course, the blockade is still going on. Like, all of these different influences are affecting everything, as they still are, you know. And that very much played into the Cuba that I first met and saw and understood. And that's the Cuba that we see in this book.
Yeah. You've described the feeling of being in Cuba as that of being a ghost, of traveling the streets that you recognized in your imagination, either from your family or from books that you'd read,
right,
and recognizing them in a certain way and through a certain lens. And you've chosen to tell this book from the perspective of a ghost or an ancestral spirit. Mm-hmm. And that arose partially from a conversation you had with a friend, Samuel Reynolds. So talk to us about that conversation and how that sparked the idea of telling the story that you wanted to tell from the perspective of a spirit.
Yeah. I was about to go off to do my master's in creative writing. And I was walking around Brooklyn with Sam one day, and I was thinking about that. And I realized I would have this period of time in which to write something not for publication at all, something that was purely just a book that I wanted to write. And, you know, outside of all that other trappings of getting published, I knew I wanted to publish eventually, but, you know. So I wanted to take that opportunity and just write something different than what I usually wrote and just see what happened. And it was Sam who said something like, oh, yeah, what happened to the spirits in the Isle of Pines? And the Isle of Pines is a famous Cuban prison, which was actually a panopticon, which I find so fascinating, in part because I was obsessed with panopticons in college. You know, the Foucault theory of the all-seeing eye, and of course, and like the way that we take on the prison guards inside of ourselves and create a tiny prison guard in our head and act accordingly. And as a theory of power, it rings true in so many fascinating ways, both here in the United States and in Cuba, in very different ways. But the way that power manifests to that degree of complication, like, it just captured my imagination so much in college. And it wasn't until later I found out that some of my family members had been imprisoned in that very panopticon-style prison. But that whole journey certainly speaks to the haunting of being a child of exile and of wondering, the haunting that our own imagination does as we think about what was it like for them, you know, what was it like for the people that fought, sometimes died, or suffered for us to have the life we have, which we think of as boring, you know? And that's like this sort of central tension, I think, to this generational conflict of those who got away and those who, you know, survived and fought and struggled, and then those who are the children of those people who you know, have these wonderful lives that we take for granted very often and wonder infinitely what it was like for the people that, you know, had these adventures, which are actually terrifying, you know, which actually caused trauma. But we see in movies as like just things that people do, you know, shooting bad guys and getting shot at and running away. Which is to say, I had thought a lot about it. I didn't know how it would fit into a book, if ever, but I knew it was a gigantic thing inside of me in my imagination. So when Sam said that, it felt like there was this little stick holding a huge avalanche, and he just kicked it away. And then it was like,
yeah.
And it just I needed someone else to say it to me, because those spirits had always been in the back of my imagination. When he said it, it was like, all right, that's going to be the book.
Yeah. It feels like spirit feels like a better word than ghost, because this isn't a ghost story in like the horror genre,
right,
or
right,
the typical fantastical genre of ghosts. It's exactly. More like the lived Caribbean cosmology of ancestral spirits.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I think really makes this spirit or ghost story stand out also is that often ghosts and stories are contacting protagonists. And in this case, the ghost is the protagonist. And often ghosts are all-knowing or have access to a lot of information that the people who are alive don't. But in this case, in a way, Marisol is on a journey of self-discovery.
Yeah.
She has a fragmented sense of self and of how her life ended.
Right.
And she's on a journey to find herself.
Yep. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was something I realized as I was writing it that I really wanted to lean into, because there's kind of a turning point. There's a decision point in the process of writing this book. Is it Marisol's story? Is it Ramon's story, right? And traditionally, yes, this book would have been written for Ramon, about Ramon from his point of view. But we've seen that a lot. You know, we've seen the character who figures out that their ancestor is walking with them, and how do they maneuver through that, and then how does it become a journey to find themselves? And Ramon does have a very clear arc, I think, and really does. It is also his self-discovery. He goes from being kind of a lump to being someone who really will do something in the world and make a difference. But it is Marisol's story. And in a funny way, which I didn't realize when I was writing it, Ramon, the flesh and blood human, is her guide. You know, in the way that we're used to seeing the Virgils in the spirit form take Dante through hell.
Yeah, I didn't thought of that either. That's true.
Yes, and I think that's cool. You know, like, she relies on him the way that someone going on a journey relies on their guide. He's an unwitting guide, but he is her mechanism for finding the truth. And so but they're also just bound together. They need each other in a very uncomfortable way. And she at one point calls herself a parasite because she understands just what a toll it's taking for her to be just pouring her traumas into him night after night in order to get what she needs, really. And she has to make that choice over and over. And I think that's her dealing with that guilt / understanding that that's just the necessity of it is really a lot of what the book is about.
Mm. Well, one of the ways suspense is baked into the plot is that Marisol's life as a spirit is flickering out. So she has a limited time to find out why she is dead and under what circumstances.
Yeah.
And as you said, the main way she does this is by inhabiting Ramon's dreams and her nephew. And Ramon is a DJ, and he's also a security guard at the hospital in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And you and Ramon are far from the same person. I'm not suggesting that you're the same person.
He's taller than me.
But we do see your shared interest in music. And I suspect that your years of working as an EMT probably informed a lot of the hospital scenes. You acknowledge the often mysterious interplay between the real and the imagined in your acknowledgments when you say, "My family who survived so much and came through with their souls intact, this book is not about them. It is not based on them, but it is deeply inspired by them." I wondered, is this distinction between a book based on them versus a book inspired by them something you thought about much as you wrote, or was it something that just sort of happened automatically as you created a fictional world drawing on your own lived experience and the stories that you've heard?
Sure. It was a very distinct choice in that I knew I had to make it. I knew I had to, actually, here's a good example. When I was writing Dactyl Hill Squad, right? I didn't want to feel totally beholden to the weight of history. And that was part of what got exciting about it when I added dinosaurs to the idea of the Civil War, right? So in a way, it turned out I was tricking myself, because as it happened, I got extremely obsessed with the history part of it. And the book is totally linked to history in ways that I never thought it would have been. But I needed the out mentally to be able to just be like, oh yeah, but they were pterodactyls. So if I have to move Gettysburg a couple of weeks away from when it really happened, it's because the troops moved faster, you know, because they were on pterodactyl back or whatever, you know.
Right.
It allowed me to kind of detach some and make the story mine no matter what. A similar process, I think, was at play in that the what my family lived through in the large world scheme of things, the fact that they were very present in Cuba in the midst of the revolution was so fascinating to me, you know, as a young person and then as a writer. And it just felt like something, as I've said, that called out to be written, but I didn't want to write it in a way where I would be beholden to their actual lives. And it was never going to be a memoir, and I never wanted to write a memoir or a family history. I wanted to tell both the story of that time, but also this, or a story of that time, but really the story is of what it means to try and understand that time from far away from it. What it means to try to piece together all these scattered memories. If you think of it in a way, and I hadn't really thought of it when I was writing it, I'm just thinking of it now, but Marisol's memories are pretty much, that's what you would hear if you were talking to, you know, if Marisol lived and told her children what happened to her, it would be these small moments, right? We don't get like the everyday doldrums of living in Cuba. We, from our parents and grandparents, we hear, here was the time this happened, you know, this gigantic moment. This was when Bay of Pigs happened, and these were the things that surrounded that, right? And so in a way, like, she's piecing together the little scraps that have survived, which are the scraps, the very scraps that we would give to our children, you know, as we move forward. Mm.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Daniel Jose Older about his latest book, The Book of Lost Saints. I wanted to return to something you said at the very beginning, because when I think again of this book and of this being a book of being lost in the in-between, mm-hmm. there's another way in which I think this book is particularly gratifying and distinctive, and that's that your novel refuses the notion that there are two sides to every story, like you mentioned at the beginning. So in particular, it's refusing that there are two sides to the story of the Cuban Revolution. So it isn't suggesting that there's one story,
right.
that there's a right story, but rather that the two dominant narratives, the leftist pro-Castro revolutionary narrative and the conservative anti-Castro counter-revolutionary narrative, mm-hmm. are erasing the realities and complexities of a lot of other stories.
Perfectly put.
And that they maintain a sort of a black and white polarity by amplifying themselves at the expense of stories that maybe have more nuance and contradiction in them. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about traveling in between these two stories that take up all the oxygen in the room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said it so well. I mean, what can I add? That's very much it. I mean, it's, if you talk to almost anyone from Cuba, whether they're here or there or somewhere else, you will hear these nuances and these truths and this challenge of what it means to stay or what it means to leave, you know, and what it means to, if you stay, then survive, you know, in a country that turned out the way Cuba did, both from the blockade and from the way that Castro ran things, and all of the tragedy and trivialities that that entails, or you will hear the heartbreak of what it meant to leave and all the things that, that they left behind. And that they think about every day, you know, and that they miss and their regret sometimes. So the truth of it is in the telling and is in the many, many voices. The truth of it is also just right there in the history books if you look. The revolution itself had numerous fronts. It wasn't just Castro. And most of those people were either imprisoned or killed, disappeared, or, you know, various other things would happen. So many people disappeared. So many of the people who were very deeply committed to the revolution didn't like it becoming narrowed down to a single person, and they either turned against it but weren't necessarily pro-imperialist, or they were killed, you know, or they went into exile. And those are the stories that, that I think are really important to unearth and to really talk about as we try to delve into getting deeper into one side or the other.
Well, that's what I loved, because we get the full spectrum of different Cuban and Cuban-American characters in the Book of Lost Saints. But one thing that we see a lot of in this book, and maybe is foregrounded, is that once the revolution happens and a revolutionary government is established, and with it the beginning of community surveillance and televised public executions, is the phenomenon of revolutionaries, Cubans who fought against Batista alongside Castro and Che, becoming counter-revolutionaries, as you say, not because they're pro-imperialist. They are anti-imperialist and they've risked their lives, but they're becoming counter-revolutionaries for any number of other dissatisfactions with the way the revolution actually takes shape on the ground. So I was curious about this and was just looking.
Did you go down the rabbit hole?
I did go down the rabbit hole. It prompted me to look for real life examples. I'm just going to read a couple. So I didn't have to look very far, but Pedro Luis Diaz Lanz was Castro's personal pilot, head of the Revolutionary Air Force, smuggled arms for the revolution, but ultimately didn't want the country to go communist. And then there's Uber Matos, a school teacher who became an arms smuggler for Castro, and then ultimately a combat commander who led the liberation of Santiago de Cuba.
Yeah.
And he was appointed commander of the new government's army, but he also opposed Castro's eventual turn to communism, and he wanted to resign.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, he was arrested for treason, spent 20 years in prison, and 16 of them in solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if there were, if these figures or other figures were looming large for you as you wrote.
Absolutely. Uber Matos especially is entwined with my own family history, and I have family members who fought with him in both situations of his fighting, and
as a revolutionary and a counter-revolutionary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think he's a perfect example. You know, a name we don't know, a name we don't hear, but such a right there, you know, is such a potent and tragic story, really, of someone who fought and really at the end, you know, continued to fight for a free Cuba against all odds. And that's what we're left with, I think, when the dividing line becomes so stark.
Yeah.
Cienfuegos is another fascinating, Camilo Cienfuegos.
His disappearance,
sure. I mean, there's so many examples of just speaking out or being, you know, someone who didn't agree 100% with this one person was a death sentence. And that's something I just think, no matter what political side you're on, we can't tolerate that degree of intolerance. And that's the tragedy of it.
Well, there was one story of a revolutionary who turned against the specifics of the revolution as they took shape that made me wonder about you and your experience, mm-hmm. not only as a Cuban-American writer, but also a Cuban-American writer who happens to also be an organizer and an mm-hmm. activist. So I was reading about the writer, poet, and art critic Carlos Franchi.
Yeah.
He was the editor of the underground newspaper put out by the revolutionaries. And when the revolution established itself as a government, he was put in charge of the new government newspaper. But by the late 60s, he'd broken with Castro's government over political differences.
Right.
He opposed the Soviet invasion of Yugoslavia, and he lived in exile. But he was shunned in exile by Cuban exiles because of his role supporting the revolution in the first place.
Right.
So he was literally living in an in-between.
Yes.
He had rejected the Castro-led revolution and been rejected by the Cuban exile community for supporting revolution at all. And this made me wonder about what it would be like to be like you, a left-wing mm-hmm. Cuban-American, mm-hmm. an activist organizer who isn't pro-Castro,
mm-hmm.
but I'm assuming is anti-Batista.
Very much so.
I wonder this because on the one hand, while this is starting to change, Cuban Americans have largely identified as Republican, with 57% of Cuban Americans in Florida voting for Trump.
Right.
So the anti-Castro Cuban American community, at least the one that has the most institutional power, you would be out of step with.
Yeah.
But then I also think about what it must be like to do activism with non-Cuban progressives
right.
in the United States, because many of them view Che and Castro much like I imagine people view Haile Selassie, as iconic, almost mm-hmm. mythic figures mm-hmm. and as symbols of successful resistance against colonial powers,
mm-hmm.
which puts you maybe mm-hmm. like Franchi in a sense, like in the in-between.
Yes.
I mean, I'm imagining into your life, but I'm curious about your lived life
sure.
as a writer activist, creating narratives
right.
that perhaps neither side want to actually hear.
Right. Right. No, that's a very good analogy. And Carlos Franchi is famous for also being disappeared from a photograph. I don't know if you saw that in the
And he
in
wrote a
research.
Poem about it.
He wrote a great poem about it, which I was thinking about recently. But yeah, and he wrote a pretty fascinating memoir too, which on the cover has the photograph before he was erased from it and the one after.
Because the government didn't want evidence that he was a pivotal figure
with anybody, right?
Yeah.
Or close enough to Castro, you know, because it's specifically with right. Castro, and he's like in the background, you know, it's not even like they're shaking hands,
right?
But he couldn't have even been seen as nearby, which is really speaks to the fragility of gigantic power is so fragile. But back to your question, absolutely, you know, and I think the struggle for me, there's a lot of struggles, you know, of course, and some of that is in having difficult conversations with family. Some of it is having difficult conversations with friends and fellow organizers. And ultimately, like, your people are the ones who you listen to and who will listen to you. And that's sort of what it comes down to, is being able to have uncomfortable conversations. Activist circles that can't have uncomfortable conversations are doomed. You can't you can't organize with someone who can't hear your truth. Ultimately, you know, imperialism is the bigger problem in the world because it's global, because it's gone on for centuries, you know, because it's killed many, 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 many more people. That being true doesn't mean that we get to then just pretend everything is fine in Cuba, you know. And I think the degree of disinformation that happens around Cuba is startling and is painful to sort of feel and see, having you know, family history involved with that. And but it, again, it comes down to being able to talk to people or not, and then knowing, like, okay, you know, if we can't have this conversation, then it's either just a topic we don't touch, or one of us steps away.
Yeah,
and that is hard, but yeah, that is also part of the work.
Well, it was so great having you on the show today, Daniel.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
We are talking today to Daniel Jose Older about his latest book, The Book of Lost Saints. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Words and Pictures, SW Concert talks with Frank Young about the unique aesthetic, history, and influence of Little Lulu.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll show the documentary film The Cave on Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Cave is a story of female doctors saving lives in a secret underground hospital in Syria. The film follows the women as they contend with daily bombardments, chronic supply shortages, and the ever-present threat of chemical attacks. It paints a stirring portrait of courage, resilience, and female solidarity. Again, that's The Cave on Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater.